All right, so first I will thank my collaborators, Rémi Lé, Henri Vincenti, Brendan Godfrey, Patrick Lear-Haber, as well as the physicist who are helping us, Cameron Geddes, Eric Azarek, Carl Schroeder, and Wim Lehmans. So I'll talk first about the physics problems that are of interest here, astrophysical shocks or jets and plasma accelerations, and talk a bit of the choice of Lorentz frame for the simulation. Talk about particle in cell method basics, but you had already some presentation about this from Mohamed. And then standard Boris and Lorentz invariance particle pusher, some new development also on field solvers, on current deposition, talk about numerical Cherenkov instability that is an issue for the simulation of both of these physics problems. If I have time, I'll take something about exascale supercomputing and common tools. So we've seen quite a bit about astrophysical shocks, but this is not what we simulate at, in our group at Berkeley Lab. We simulate plasma-based accelerators where we have either a laser beam or a particle beam that propagates through a plasma, creates a wake, and you can use this the wake that has very intense electric field, much more intense than you can otherwise produce in usual cavities in accelerator, to accelerate a beam much more efficiently. So we are working on this to develop much, much shorter and compact accelerators. So why is it relevant? And that's why, as I say, with a twist, because in your case here, you have plasmas that are moving at relativistic velocities. Here we have the beam also moving at relative velocities, but otherwise the plasma is just standing there. So it becomes closer when you look at what the challenges are for the simulation. So if we look at first principle simulation using PIC for a 10 GeV scale stage, we have a short laser wavelength, about 1 micron, 0.8 exactly, that propagates through a 1 meter plasma. So that means that you need a million of time step to do the simulation. That's, I mean, you do it for your 1D already, it's expensive. We need to do that in 3D. So that becomes very expensive. So the way around that is to do the simulation into a different frame. So again, configuration in a lab frame, we have a 1 micron laser to a 1 meter plasma. Ratio of scales is 1 million. That gives you the number of time steps that you need to resolve it. But if you go into another frame that goes at gamma of 100, which is close to the group velocity of the laser in the plasma here, then for a given density of the plasma, then now your plasma is shorter by a factor of gamma, so by 100. Laser wavelength before it enters the plasma is longer by 1 plus beta gamma. You do the ratio now of the two scales for the laser to cross the plasma, and thus the interaction to occur, and you need now only 50 or so time steps. So you have a compaction of the range of scale of about 20,000, and that translates into the same speed up for your simulations. So this is just to show that it has been tried and it works. Here we see the electric field at a given position recorded as a function of time, and you see the wake that develops here, and here this is the loading from the beam that deforms the wake at this position. And this is from simulation in the lab frame, and then simulation into various boosted frame, and reconstructed into the lab, and you see only one curve. You barely distinguish the others because, of course, you resolve the same physics. So if you do the things right, and you see that you get the same things later, that if you look at the electron beam that is accelerated, you get the same history, and so on for various quantity, momentum, spread, beta oscillation of the electron beam, and so on. So this has been scale to very high energies. So if you go to lower and lower plasma density, you can accelerate your electrons higher and higher, and you use a higher and higher boost for the simulation. And we demonstrated some speed up of up to 1,000,000 for an hypothetical 1 TeV stage laser plasma accelerator. That will never be built, but that was a good case to demonstrate that we could do the numerics to a very high gamma. So that's true for laser plasma acceleration, but it's much more general and applies to actually just the crossing of two objects that propagate at the relativistic speed with regard to each other. And if you look very chemically at the range of scales, so starting with two identical beams, say it could be laser beam or particle beams, doesn't matter, then you see that the if you look at the range of scales in space and time in the frame that is in the mass frame of these two beams, and if you compare that to the rest frame of one of the two beams, then you find out that if you do the range of scales, so basically comparing this large T here over this delta T, large L, the small l, and you can see here how that just because of the contraction and dilation in space and time, then this range is not a Lorentz invariant. For an initial gamma of these two beams, you can derive how the range of scale evolves as you change the gamma at which you look at the interaction, and that gives you the type of speed up that you can get for your simulation, and you find out that it scales as a 1 plus beta gamma square. So that was demonstrated for plasma accelerator, as just show you, for Acron laser, also some two-stream instability that are closer to the case of interest for you. And the question is, can it apply to two-stream instability of relevant to BLASAR studies? So I will just first show the other two-stream instability that it applies to, which is a case that is of relevance for particle accelerators, when there's such as LHC, for example, where you may have some background of electrons, residual electrons that could interact with the beam, and you can have a so-called beam breakup electron cloud instability that ensures. So it's transverse instability, and you see how a beam that is fully Gaussian by interacting through a background of electrons gets this corkscrew motion after some distance. I'll show you the movie in a minute. So that's the beam initially, then it's, oops, sorry, that's, how do we start this, maybe? So it propagates through a density that is initially zero of electrons, then it's flat, and then goes down. So we see the beam. So initialized through a plane, so that we have exact Lorentz correspondence between the simulation in the lab frame and in a boosted frame. And you see the, okay, I see. When I use the laser, it stops the simulation. Okay, so you see the electrons density, the flow of electron that sorry?
You can use the hopstick.
That's okay. I mean, you can see. And you see the instability that develops. And the point is that whether you do the simulation in the lab frame or in a boosted frame, you get exactly the same growth of the transverse size of the beam, and except that in the lab frame simulation took 2 weeks, in the boosted frame it took less than 30 minutes, so a speed up of about 1,000 for this case. So I was wondering yesterday if we could adapt this to a case close to what Mohamed is simulating. So I did some simulation, so it's very fresh, so I do not guarantee that this is right. I don't have time to verify everything. But so what I did is take a beam of positrons plus electrons with an initial gamma of 10 that flows through a plasma of protons and electrons that is at rest with the initial small thermal temperature, and then let it let it flow. The ratio of plasma, the density is 1,000 times the beam density. So we see some modulation that is appearing and then develops, and things are becoming nonlinear and start mixing. And now for simulation in a boosted frame, so not too high here because the frame, the initial beam gamma is not very high, say 1.5 gamma equal 2. And looking at the movie and choosing snapshot that looks similar to the other one, then we see that the physics look certainly strangely similar between the various frames here. So the size of the box was adjusted, of course, that we would get the same number of oscillation through the Lorentz transformation. So if we look now at the history of field energy versus time, because it grows from noise, the onset of the instability is not guaranteed to start at the same time. So I do a little shift here of the one of the simulations so that it's closer together. So we see that basically we have a growth rate that is fairly similar and a saturation level, which is also fairly similar. But one thing to note is you see here the number of time steps for each simulation, gamma equal 1, 1.5, 2, multiplied by gamma squared 1 plus beta, so by the speed up factor. So, and we see that they track each other, which means that the gamma equal 1.5 is 4 times faster, the other one is 7.5 faster. So that means that if now you want to do a simulation where it's gamma 100, or maybe gamma million, you can pick maybe a gamma of 1,000, times square times 2, then you can eventually have a speed up of a million times and be able to do the simulation that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. One thing also to notice is that the simulation at higher gamma is less noisy. So I've not analyzed to understand exactly why is that. One possibility is that because we use a much lower number of time step, then the errors that appear just by accumulation of time stepping is lower. That's a possibility, but there may be others required. So, but that would certainly go into the right direction for having quieter simulation. Okay, so I'll go now to the particle in cell methods itself. So as you know, it's a method that is widely used for modeling plasma because it includes all nonlinear 3D kinetic effects. Particle push and electromagnetic solver are local, which means that it scales well to many, many cores on big supercomputers. The main core loop is very simple. We push particle Newton Lorentz, deposit charge and current, do the field solve of Poisson or Maxwell, gather the forces and loop. We eventually add some filtering of charge and currents and potential and fields, and also eventually have some absorption and emission for ionization, other types of events. So the codes that we are using here is WARP. That's an open source PIC. So standard particle in cell, you can do all sort of plasma physics with it, but it also has accelerator modules to have all the lattice, focusing element, accelerating element of an accelerator. And it's part of the Berkeley Lab Accelerator Simulation Toolkit, or BLAST. You can look at the website for BLAST and then find the one for WARP. WARP is almost the same. It's warp.lbl.gov. And then you can find more information, find how to install the code, and can try it if you wish. So what's new on particle pusher side? So the standard pusher is the porous pusher that is just does a finite difference in space, and then another finite difference for the velocity push, which has a little trick here in order to integrate the V Crosby push, make it somewhat implicit. And so Boris had a trick here where he was using the average of the gamma times V divided by the gamma in the center of the push, then splitting the electric and magnetic push in two half electric, then the magnetic rotation in the middle. I don't describe it, but basically by construction, it is an actual rotation that happens. And it's, so it's fully explicit and easy to implement. But we had a problem with this when we First time I tried to do the simulation of the beam through the electron background, the beam exploded, and I could not understand what was going on until I tracked down the problem to the Boris Pusher, which, so the beam is ultra-relativistic, you know, gamma equals 500, which means, but it has a significant space charge that will make it explode if the cancellation E plus V cross B is not good enough. And it turns out that the Boris Pusher, by construction, does not do a good job with the E plus V cross B cancellation. Actually, you can look at, analyze it in details, and you find that having some E plus V cross B that tends towards zero implies E equal B equals zero. So that tells you that is not something that is desirable, meaning you get large errors when the E plus V cross B is close to zero or ultra-relativistic beam. It turns out the solution was fairly simple. At least formally, to fix that issue was to simply take the average of the velocity here instead of the term that Boris had introduced. And it turns out that was integrable analytically, and then you get an expression that you can put on the code, in the code, and then get a solver, which now is Lorentz invariant. And that's a test case here of having in the laboratory frame just a particle that is circling with a transverse magnetic field. And if you use a time step that's small enough, you see that the Boris Pusher, or for those who know the Boris Pusher with the so-called tangent alpha correction, does a very good job at tracking your particle. But now you solve the same problem in a moving frame where you have an E cross B drift, then you see that the Boris Pusher and even the one with the tangent alpha correction start to diverge here. But you see that the new Pusher tracks the analytical solution perfectly. So we've also worked on field solvers. So the issue, the most common field solver is the so-called Yee solver, which is second order in space and in time, and achieve second order in space by staggering the quantities of the electric field and magnetic field in a special way so that you have centered finite difference in space and time of your curls and divs. Now, the issue with the Yee solver is it's finite difference, so it's not perfect. You have some numerical dispersion. So if you look at the dispersion relation solution here, so the red curve is along an axis, and the blue curve is at 45 degrees. So this is solution in 2D at the current limit. You have no numerical dispersion at 45 degrees, but you see that the highest K mode that you can support in the direction of the axis goes roughly at 2/3 the speed of light and not at the speed of light as it should. And the way it manifests itself, you can see very easily by just having a Kronecker that you let expand, and you see this ripple here coming from the mode that propagates lower than the speed of light. So there's been some work to improve this. There's been some so-called non-standard finite differences that were introduced by Cole in the late 90s, which instead of just doing a finite difference by taking two values and differencing them, introduce also some averaging in the direction that is transverse to the differentiation. And you get then a number of free parameters to adjust. And with this, then you can basically adjust your numerical dispersion to some degree. And you see here one of the implementation that gives you no numerical dispersion along the main axis at the price of having some numerical dispersion at 45 degrees now. So you, depending on the on your problem, that can improve, you know, if you want to have the laser propagate at C and have the right group and phase velocity, then it's very important to have no dispersion along the main axis. And there's been some variations of this that have been introduced. But we wanted to, I mean, and you'll see why we needed to have even better solvers. So in order to go to even better solvers, starting from what we have is, so that would be finite difference solvers order 4. And you get more and more precise in the differentiation by going to higher and higher order. You have larger and larger stencil to push your Maxwell equation, and that converges to very high order to something like this, where now it's isotropic, but you get superluminal waves at high k's. So in order to converge now to the exact solution, you need to go to smaller time step. You see that if you subcycle your Maxwell solver by a factor of 10, for example, then you get to the solution where it's not only isotropic, but also very close to the speed of light at every angle. Problem, of course, is if you have higher order 64 and subcycling of 10, then it's a very expensive solver. So when it's so expensive, then it's more economical to do an FFT. And then you can rewrite your solvers. Basically, just you simply take the Fourier transform of the fields, you push them in k-space, you then transform them back in real space, and you push them with standard leapfrog this way. So that gives you something that is as good as having very, very high order. In practice, actually, it's equivalent to infinite order. So this is nice, but it's still expensive because you need still to go to very small time step in order to have no numerical dispersion whatsoever. Well, it turns out that this was solved in the 73, I think, by Irv Haber. Turns out that once you are in k-space, well, you can integrate analytically the equations, and now you have a pusher that looks like this, where you have a few terms here, and now you can basically, since it's analytical, there's no current condition anymore. And so where with the standard solver here, I would need for say 50 time step to get from the Kronecker delta to this solution, I got this in one time step. Okay. Obviously, once you put the particles back, you still have, you know, limited by the particles. But at least it has some very nice properties. Now, one issue with those solvers, and that's why spectral solver went in favor in the 70s, 80s, and then they faded because of parallel computing. Okay, so the issue if we want to use the solver is that how do we scale that to many, many cores? There are some FFT that scale to a very large number of cores, but you better have very good supercomputer, very, very fast interconnect. And if we look further down the road with billion of cores, it's not obvious that we'll be able to scale FFT that far. But it turns out, so basically the issue with spectral is that if you have global communication, it's hard to scale. While FDTD has local communication, it's easy to scale. But turns out here we can get help from the physics because we're solving Maxwell, we're not solving Poisson. So we can take advantage of the fact that we don't need the solution to be communicated all across the machine between two finite time steps. So the way it works is one way, there's several ways of doing it, but that's exemplified here. So let's say we have the solution at some point on one grid. We separate that into two subdomains, and we take local FFT. So that's very important. Each FFT now is local to each of these subdomains. And we have a number of guard cells in which we keep the solution up to the middle of the guard cells. Now we advise this for finite time. Obviously, because of the cutoff here, we have some spurious solution that develop. But thanks to the finite speed of light for the finite time step, that will be contained to the guard cells region, so that you can copy the unaffected data, you know, into the guard cell region and replace the spurious solution by the correct solution. And once you're done, you zero out the remaining area here, and then you basically back into the same configuration as the previous time step, but further in time, and you can go further. So
in practice, how do you decide where to cut?
Here is just for example, we could cut, we could actually not cut at all. Okay, and actually how you cut matters, and I will get to that. So here is just an example with not just two domain, but 45 domain, 7x7, only local FFTs again. Okay, no global FFTs. Signals start here, and you see that it has propagated as it, you know, normally using this trick to the entire domain. So this way, basically, you can use FFT solver, very high order, but still have local domain, so you can scale to large number of calls. So that was successfully tested on some simulation of laser plasma acceleration. So compared to finite difference, it's quieter. We see here some spurious numerical noise, which is not there. And for boosted frame simulation, it's much also quieter with regard to something. It's called numerical triangle that I will describe later. So to partially answer your question is, yes, Maxwell is local, the FFT is still a global operation. And the FFT, if you do not do anything special, is equivalent to doing finite difference with a stencil of infinite order. Okay, which means that if you have guard cells, finite number of guard cells, and you cut it, then that means you're cutting the stencil effectively. Okay, and so you make a little approximation, and we need to make sure that this will not grow. Okay, actually, tests show that there is actually constructive interferences that, you know, when you exchange the data, that may make it grow, and then your simulation become unstable. So in order to study that, we have developed, that's the work of Henry Vincenti, a new theory, which I will not describe in detail, but basically it does some calculation similar to Fabry-Perot, you know, for having all the interferences between all the cutoff that you do, and integrate all this and give you basically the stability, okay, the error that you make and the stability of your scheme. And one important result that we have observed is that if you use infinite order, you have this slope, the error as a function of number of guard cell goes down relatively slowly. But if you use very high order, which you can do, it's very easy, you modify the case, you know, the wave numbers, then you see that now it goes down dramatically at some point. And so you can use, for example, order 1000, which is super high, and have 100 guard cells, and you know that you are good to machine precision. Okay, so that's one way to know how many guard cells to use and how to cut. The theory was also useful to verify that perfectly matched layers that are used to surround simulation domain to simulate vacuum work well also with a spectral solver. That was not completely obvious. PML is local. Spectral solver, again, has a very large stencil. But we verified that it worked actually just as well as with standard finite difference. So that's good. All right, so numerical Cherenkov instability. So this is something that was discovered by Brendan Godfrey in the 70s. At least for the main mode, it's very simple to understand. So if you have a beam that propagates close to the speed of light, and you solve this with the Maxwell, you know, solver, then you have the two lines for Maxwell and the beam that intersect only at zero, and there's no instability. Now, if you use finite difference solver, as we've seen, the you have some numerical dispersion, and now you don't have a straight line for Maxwell, the two line cut, and there you have some instability. And obviously, it's easy to see the correlation with the physical Cherenkov, so that's why it was called a numerical Cherenkov. So in addition, if you look at 2D and 3D, you have to take into account the fact that you have aliases. So this is the same picture as before, but now in 2D with the light cones. And so the normal light cone with exact Maxwell and the deformed light cone with a standard finite difference. So you see that even if you use the perfect pseudo-spectral solver, which will give you this dispersion. So if we had only this, it would be stable. But because you use we have finite time step and finite cell size, we have aliases. And now the aliases, the planes here, they come and cut through the light cone, and the intersections are unstable. So it's easy to compute the intersection and to get the mapping that you see here in omega kz and kx kz for some given numbers. But in order to predict it and mitigate it, you need to derive the full numerical dispersion relation, which is difficult, but fortunately, Brendan Godfrey was retiring right at the right moment and was happy to help us with this. And he did it, so I won't go through it. It's a few pages of equations. And you simplify this and put that into Mathematica and solve. And so this is what Brendan got from his Mathematica notebook. Predicting the growth rates versus K, and we did some peak simulation with warp, and you see that we've got a very good agreement between the two. So having this, we could do the predictions of the growth rates for various field solvers, like the standard Yi or another one with a larger stencil that we talked about, versus time step. And also with the pseudo-spectral solvers. And remark is there was a so-called magical time step, which we had already found empirically, that was explained by the theory. And also the theory was showing that a spectral solver were much, much more stable to start with. Not 100%, it does not completely get rid of numerical Cherenkov. I want to point out that it's not exactly zero here, but it's much, much smaller. And this is just the confirmation here using a warp to do laser plasma acceleration simulation, recovering the results. So there's been quite a bit of work done on the analysis and on the developing some separation method to mitigate numerical Cherenkov, both by Brendan with us and also by researchers at UCLA. So one of the solutions that was derived by Brendan for finite difference codes is to use a filter, 9-point filter in real space. And one of the key thing of this filter is that the correction of the transverse electric field is slightly different from the one in the magnetic field. And this is to correct from an inaccuracy of the solver for the particular case that we've been looking at. And only the analysis that Brendan or similarly is done at UCLA can give you all the information to derive these solvers. And this works beautifully. So you can see here the growth rate, so energy at the end of the simulation. So one tells you the simulation is stable, larger than one it's unstable. And so for various cases, without using the special filter, then except for the magical time step, it's unstable. Now using the new filter, it's very stable at any time step. And so some filters have been designed also for spectral solver, but I don't have time to, you can go to the references that were given earlier. Okay, so I will talk a little bit about exascale supercomputing, so looking at where we are going. So those are the three largest supercomputers of the Department of Energy in the US. So Titan with a peak performance 27 petaflop, Mira 10 petaflop, Edison at NERSC at 2.5 petaflop. So the big target now is to have computers of one exaflop, so about 100 times the computational power of this computer here by 2025. So you see here that's the map here, that's the current computers. By 2020, having about 100 to 300 petaflop, and 2024, one exaflop, and 2028, 5 to 10. So basically a factor of 100 to 1,000 in the next 10 years. So that obviously we want to take advantage of this, but as you know, the frequency of the clock frequency of the cores have been plateauing, as well as single thread performance, so on. So in order to have this big massive machine, the number of cores has to go up. Okay, so we're talking for this machine up to maybe billion of cores. So what it means for us is that we cannot just have domain decomposition with MPI message passing and we're done. We have to have what's called multi-level parallelism, where we have, in addition to the MPI, some thread parallelism using OpenMPI. And this is not that new, but so far, at least for standard electromagnetic peak code, tests were showing that using either MPI or MPI plus OpenMPI was giving about the same speed. So there was no big incentive to use both. This is about to change. At least that's what we've been told. So anyway, so that you have several levels of parallelism that you need to take care of is that, so you decompose your domain into various, areas. So this is very standard. Then you decompose further inside each node. You have several cores. Then what we do here is some tiling. So we re-decompose further inside each node, but using now some OpenMPI parallelisms. And then we need also to use what's called vectorization, where you can execute many of the same operation at once. So for vectorization, we've been looking at that recently, and we've tested the algorithms that were developed in the 70s to 90s on the Cray supercomputers, for example. And what we found was that those algorithms were not working well for the new architectures, because they required very, very long vector, which we do not have at this point. So a new algorithm was developed by Henry Vincenti, where, so basically we do some extra definition of arrays for the deposition of current. So that's for the linear deposition here, so then quadratic, then cubic. So if we were going to fifth order, as you do, then we would have to devise something here. But the idea is that you see that each time it's groups of eight, okay, because this is the length of the vector for the machine he was targeting. And then we have these little arrays in cache that fill into the very, very fast cache and also can be vectorized, and you get some good speed up. So basically on Haswell, he got between 2.1 to 2.4 speed up using these algorithms. The max is 4, but it's very, very difficult to get to the latest, more speed up. So developing this big code demands a lot of resources, and there are many big big codes that have been developed so far, and with not enough collaboration to the like, and so and for example, you as a user, you simulate some two-stream instability or something, you get a result. It doesn't compare, match the experiments or the observations, something like this. You'd like to use another code. Using another code means learning another code, how to input the parameters, how to read the data, and all this. So in order to help in this regard, we've been collaborating on developing a new common module and data format. So that's called OpenPMD for simulation of particle and meshes. And what it does is to specify how to layout the data. It's still using a standard data format like HDF5 or NetCDF or whatever you've been using, but it basically says, okay, the particles will be laid out this way, the fields will be laid out this way, so that if you have a file that has been written with this format, whether you use a code or another code, then you can read it. And you can use that to exchange file between codes. We've been doing that a lot now, or compare results. Then you have data that has the same layout. There's also a viewer that's available using IPython. It's been implemented in a few codes, and it's open source, and you can get it at this. So going further, what we're working on is a repository that's called Particle in Cell Scalable Application Resource that has an open source collection of pill kernel subroutines. And the idea is that we'll develop these subroutines collaboratively. It'll be open source. Everyone can look at it, can propose some better version, and this way, we would converge to some very optimized subroutines that can benefit the community as a whole. And testing, comparing, etc. And it's not available to the wider community soon, but we are in the process of getting it licensed for open source and all that. You can send me an email if you're interested. All right, that's the conclusion, and it's basically just repeating what I just said. I will stop. Thank you.
So we have time for a few questions.
I think this is really a great trick to do this in a frame that is moving. But doesn't that make it very complicated to identify individual modes? Because a purely longitudinal one, if you do the Lorentz transformation, will be transverse and so, and then you have to disentangle back. Is that
that's so easy? Yes. No. So we have modules that as the simulation is running, save the data into files so for us that would be the lab frame. So whatever frame that you want to loop the data at.
Then the picture set you showed, this was always referring to the co-moving frame, or was it already transformed back to
which ones?
Well, you just said you had done the simulations yesterday.
So those ones, yes, those ones were not transformed back, except for the comparison of the growth rates.
Yeah.
The other ones, they were in the boosted frame, yeah.
So I have a question about filtering. We can look and we see, make prediction about numerical instabilities, and we can tweak our filter or solver to remove these instabilities. But how do you know that you don't change the physics? Or how would you assess the change in the physics of the problem due to filtering?
Yeah. You always filter in some way. I mean, whether you use higher shape function or you filter the current, you always have some ways of smoothing things, right? However, you know what filter you apply, so you know which band of physics is covered and which one is damped. And I mean, as with other numerical parameters, whether it's the filter, cell size, number of time step, time step size, etc., is, you know, you vary them, do some type of convergence study to make sure that it's not sensitive to it.
Yeah, but the problem with the filter is, like, if you using filter that's using nine stencils and you try to study convergence and you like decrease the size of your filter, you're kind of always running into the numerical instability. So.
Well, the good news is that the growth rate of the numerical instability goes down with resolution, so that as you do your convergence study, then you can not only your filter, because it's number of points, it becomes narrower and narrower, so you filter less, but you can also decrease the amount of filtering that you do simply because you are also more stable, and eventually at some point you may not need the filter. So it's lucky it goes into the right direction, so that you cover more and more of the spectral content as you increase the resolution.
For particular acceleration applications, how far are you from a one-to-one simulation when one particle in the real world is one particle in the computer?
For plasma acceleration, especially for the plasma. Yeah. For the beam, if the beam is not too dense, we may be closer, but we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. For most standard accelerators, like front end of free electron lasers, we routinely do the simulation with billions of particles, and then that's the actual numbers. But we're not there yet for plasma acceleration.
Further questions? Well, let's thank Jean-Luc again.
Okay.